Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the OIG Roundtable. Eric Rubenstein, Senior Director of Litigation, Fraud, Waste, Abuse, joined by my counterpart, of course, Matt Kachansky, the retired SAC from the OIG, the retired Northeast UPIC Director, and my counterpart running our payment integrity team. And unfortunately, Wade's on one of our larger CMS contracts, and they are embroiled right now in some very large clinical audits on behalf of CMS, and he's working as a project manager, so he unfortunately gets pulled out for a lot of those at the last minute. So again, it's the OIG coffee table today.
It's the summer of audits.
It's the summer of audits. These clinical audits happen to be, we're in the middle of the season, auditing season. So Wade is pulled apart from the team to do to work on some of that stuff as a project manager. So we'll do an OIG coffee table. So today we want to talk about, everybody's been seeing the roundup that occurred, the national healthcare fraud takedown that occurred. These are occurring once or twice a year and have been going on for at least the past 7 or 8 years, give or take. And they really do parlay themselves off of what originally were the Strikeforce takedowns. And then they started off as the Strikeforce takedowns. And then as more Strikeforce regions came online, they started coordinating the Strikeforces. And now they've just become a national kind of thing. What typically happens is that the gear up for these is months and months in advance. And what also winds up happening is that when these are coordinated through HHS OIG's headquarters and DOJ with its agency partners, they typically will solicit different districts and say, do you have any cases that are going to be ripe for prosecution in this period of time? And that's why what you oftentimes will see is some districts participating, some districts not participating. They might not have a case. Some of your districts where they may not have any healthcare fraud cases that are in process, or they may not have a case that's ripe for prosecution. But this one, large, right? Over 400 people arrested, billions and billions of dollars, Dr. Evil, billions and billions of dollars in billed amounts. And we always want to stress that when you see it says, you know, $4 billion in claims, it's $4 billion in claims. It is not necessarily $4 billion or $5 billion or whatever that number may be in paid amounts. It's what's been billed. So this was a big one, over 400 people arrested and billions of dollars. And it really did span across everything from the traditional healthcare fraud. The DEA was heavily involved in a bunch of revocations and things of that sort. What made this one interesting was this is one where we did see tens of millions of dollars in cases that were being worked through Office of Counsel to the Inspector General for HHS, or what's known as OSIG, and a bunch of cases under what's known as the CMPL, Civil Monetary Penalties Law. And those are administrative cases in which the U.S. Attorney's offices are not involved. It's handled by the internal litigation team there. And Matt, you know, that's an office. They also handle, right, exclusions, mandatory permissives. For a while, when you were at headquarters, you ran that team in conjunction with OSIG. You were the analysts that were doing it. And so for me, it was refreshing to see that OSIG, I don't want to say they stepped up their game, but that OSIG was much more heavily involved and prominently noted in a lot of these press releases from DOJ and HHS relative to OSIG's work, which is showing that the healthcare fraud prosecutions, they're now really trying to plug a lot of holes between CMS suspensions and then OSIG coming in and doing these CMP cases, that they really are taking a whole of agency approach, to this.
Yeah, they filled that nice gap where, you know, it kind of, the cases meet the legal elements of a civil fraud case, but maybe don't have the dollars involved that would be of interest to a U.S. attorney's office. So they picked those up. In the past, those were few and far between. So seeing tens of millions of dollars on this roundup, that's a great utilization of this tool and that resource that has been probably underutilized for many years.
Yeah, and that's the thing is that the CMPs were typically only cases that you knew about because as an OIG agent you worked on them, right, or there might have been a press release that came out, but it's one of those tools where, by the way, for those that aren't familiar with CMP cases, civil monetary penalty cases, they really do kind of mirror what a civil U.S. Attorney's Office civil case would be. The statute is similar to the False Claims Act. Instead of a civil complaint, the OSIG issues what's known as a demand letter, which is the functional equivalent of a civil complaint. Oftentimes, OSIG will submit what they call a pre-demand letter, which is, you know, we have information that suggests this, would you like to come in and talk to us, or we're going to go about doing our thing. You then get, instead of a grand jury or a HIPAA subpoena, you get an OIG subpoena. And instead of a deposition, they call it a testimonial subpoena. So it's not a it's not a subpoena for a deposition, but it's the same thing. It's a deposition.
And that's one of the few in-person subpoenas that the OIG can utilize related to the CMPs. When I was there, I did one of the first ones with Greg Dembski, was the attorney that handled it for me. It's in front of an administrative law judge, but it is similar to a civil trial where you've got to meet the elements of civil fraud and present the evidence that you've gathered, and the judge makes the ALJ makes a decision on what the final damages are, and then there's similar penalties and fines on top of that, similar to a civil false claims act.
Yeah, we can have a whole, I've worked on a bunch of those, and they're interesting. And what makes them interesting, at least from my perspective, was always that you're working directly with an OSIG lawyer. I had one particular OSIG lawyer that I worked with for probably 10 or 11 years, who I became very good friends with after he left government service. But what you get is, if you work with the same attorney or the same couple of attorneys, you get to have a really good working relationship. You know what they're looking for. You know how to put together a package for them. It's no different than working with an AUSA, but you're also working with someone who really, really has very deep knowledge of healthcare fraud, waste, abuse. And so it's a little bit of a different relationship. But it was interesting to see this. But, the thing that's interesting in these cases, on these roundups, is what people don't often realize is the amount of work in the back end is really insurmountable, but the coordination of effort and the amount of time that it takes. And so from an SIU perspective, one of the things that, I think oftentimes we don't think about is, how do we work as more of a cohesive team of people? And this is a great example. If you've got a case involving a multiple provider group, right, multi-specialty, multi-provider group, and you have potentially a lot of members that you need to interview, one of the things that you've got to have is the ability to understand how to coordinate that. Obviously, we know that, and our team does a great job, and not that I'm trying to make this an advice sales pitch, because advice, I think, sells itself in a lot of ways, but one of the things that we are inordinately good at doing are these kind of multifaceted things, because a lot of us came from the OIG. We have a fairly large number of people here relative in our SIU team that worked on multi-jurisdictional, multi-venue, multi-specialty, multi-member cases, where that coordination takes some expertise, some time, some training. But one of the things I think that often becomes the piece of the puzzle is making sure that everybody is on that same page. For example, if you're talking to members and your topic is the same, it's getting everybody on the same page on those interviews and getting the questions right and all of that. And that becomes a big piece of any of these kinds of cases, whether it's an SIU or it's a law enforcement operation.
Yeah. The logistics, the coordination, the communication are hugely important, especially in an environment where everybody's virtual. Everybody's got to be singing off the same song, the songbook. And it takes a manager, to do this and to coordinate it, to almost to the point of writing out the questions, getting background folders on each of the people that are going to be interviewed, so the people that are going to be doing the interview understand the context of the questions that they're asking, and that they have the goals in mind of, what is this person supposed to be providing you, and how best to get to it? And doing that across a team of 5 people, 10 people, 20 people, it's a skill, and it takes a lot of experience to do that. And you've got to use the tools around you, geolocation tools, to make sure people are going to the right places, if it's on sites and things like that. It takes a lot of background work And at the UPIC, we did multiple on-sites of groups in geographic areas where we had teams of 20 to 30 people going out on the same days, hitting these places, because we knew that if we hit one, one was going to talk to two and three and four. Right. And by the time we got to number five, they were going to be prepared. So we hit them all at once. And it took weeks just to do that. It took weeks of preparation. To do something like this national roundup, you've got to multiply that by 100 in terms of complexity.
Right, exactly. So, you know, one of the things that we've been doing here is our on-site and our surveillance teams are going out and, you know, we're doing this for some of our clients now with credentialing, where we're going out and we're doing physical on-sites and we're doing them quickly, you know, typically a few days turnaround time. We're parlaying that off of some of our other CMS contracts on the on-site inspections group that's doing that. And that footprint has helped because when we are doing, for example, if you're doing a member interview and we've done an on-site or our surveillance team has gone and done a drive-by and done pictures and all of that, and you're speaking to a member, you actually have some information in front of you in anticipation of that conversation with the member to say, well, when you go, where do you go? What does it look like? And you have the ability to provide really good information back and say, well, when you go in, is the door the one on the left that's red? Is it the one that's blue? When you're in the building, does it look like this? Like things like that, that you can glean from a conversation after the fact. But the coordination, what's important, because if you're speaking to multiple members, maybe, you know, you look and you see that the address of record for 10 of these members is the same building. They're all going to talk to each other. So do you have to make an investigative decision that you want to speak to all of these members around the same time because they're all going to chit chat afterwards in the community room of the building because that's what people do. And so how do you go about achieving that? And that's where that coordination comes into effect. And I know that we've been using a lot of the results of our surveillance teams and our investigative geolocating and geospacing things and our on-site teams to go out and be able to do that. So when member interviews do need to transpire, you have as much actionable information as possible so that you're really getting to the heart of it. If you don't have that information, you wind up spinning your wheels for 10 or 15 minutes until you get to the questions that you need to ask to get to the point that you make. So what, you know, what we can learn from the SIU space is that the playbook that the government uses in its ramp up for these large scale operations, there may be an instance where, you know, from the SIU side, we do make a decision that we need to do an on-site. And how do you make those preparations to be to do them properly? Now, the one thing that we will always say in the SIU space is that SIU teams should not be going out on a routine basis doing surveillance, drive-bys, all of that stuff. There's a whole bunch of safety, legal, liability considerations there, technology considerations. You know, we have that infrastructure to do those. And our surveillance and our on-site teams are professionally trained on how to do this. You know, you shouldn't be going out and with your personal phone taking pictures. Yeah, like all of those things are challenges that, you know, we would love to talk to plans about, you know, how to achieve that in the right way. But, you know, it's that ramp up that kind of gets to that. So I think, you know, the take home for me as we wrap up is we can learn a lot. The SIU teams and payment integrity teams can learn a lot from these roundups. And it's not so much part of it is the cases themselves. You should be reading as much of these press releases on what these schemes are, because these schemes are going to be things that maybe you weren't fully aware of or that you weren't fully conversant in understanding. And it's, again, like we talk all the time about reading the press releases. The press releases are important because they give you that intelligence that you need to see. Is your plan being affected by this? Are you being hit with these issues? But just as important is what are the things that you can do in an SIU space that come close to mirroring what law enforcement did in a reasonable and safe way.
Yep, agreed. And a lot of it is timing too, you know, because if you're talking to members and you're planning an on-site and you want to make that on-site unannounced, you've got to make that on-site as close to those interviews as possible, because you know that of the 10 members that you're talking to, one of them's going to mention it to the provider. So you've got to take that into consideration in doing the timing of these things.
Right. You got a very small window. And we just actually, I was in a meeting the other day where we actually heard a story where the provider was a DME company and they had five different locations. And what wound up happening was when they went to the first couple of locations, it was, as one would suspect, a pretty barren environment of what was there. By the time they got to location like four or five, it was like walking into Costco, right? Or one of those big box stores. The first couple locations were like, you know, an echo chamber. But by the time they got to the third or the fourth, whatever it was, that DME supplier was about as fully stocked as you can imagine, because what we suspect was wherever they had stuff, they were just moving it. It was a shell game. And, you know, somebody said, you know, geez, we got to put the wrist braces in a box on the shelf for someone to see. So it is important that you have that. And one of the things that we could always do is we could always set up our surveillance team at locations four and five, for example. I got briefed the other day on some of our new surveillance technology, and I was pretty impressed, to the extent that I thought I might need to call up the director of our training and our tech team from OIG and have them have a conversation about technology, because I couldn't believe the stuff that our tech team has been investing in. I was like, holy cow, that's pretty unbelievable. But you've got to think in those terms to be able to make your on-sites and to make your investigative skill set valuable, because in today's climate, the bad guys are becoming better at doing what they're doing.
Yeah, you've got one shot at doing that type of, you know, very invasive investigative activity. You got one shot to get inside the provider's office and to get inside his head. You've got to make it impactful. So the planning for that has to be, you know, in depth.
Right. I mean, Eminem said you only got one shot, so it's very Eminem-like of it. So
I like Eminems, the peanut ones.
Yeah, I get you. Yeah. I get you. All right. So look, I think it's great. This, you know, it'll be interesting to see how many of these people go to trial. I mean, when you've thrown everything against the wall, some of the spaghetti won't stick. And so you have to see of these people that have, you know, and when you read these press releases, what you'll learn, some of these press releases are really retro, because some of these providers have already pleaded guilty. Some of them have already settled. They just hold this in abeyance and they make it part of this national roundup. The national roundups are typically not over one day. Anybody who thinks that 400 people are being arrested in one day, these are typically going on over the course of a week or longer, and they just make it as part of this national roundup and they just do the splash at one time. So you've got to take, you know, when you're reading it, you have to see what some of them say. But, you know, we'll see what happens in some of these. You know, unfortunately, what happens is the government doesn't typically put out press releases for providers that are found not guilty after trial. Defense attorneys will typically do that. So, you know, we'll see what happens as some of these go through their paces. But obviously, what we're now seeing is a much broader spectrum, including CMS for payment suspensions, OSIG for some of the CMPs, on top of the criminal and the civil cases that continue to be out there. So interesting stuff. I think we'll see, you know, some more press releases coming out on these. Each district is putting out press releases. So I think we'll see more and more of these over the next couple of weeks. And, you know, these roundups continue to occur. And when these roundups occur, we're seeing larger dollar amounts. We're seeing, generally, we're seeing a little bit more of a more aggressive approach to these prosecutions, which is good. What I'm hoping is that we start to see more aggressive sentencing that occurs as a result of this, and larger attempts to recover the restitution amounts that are out there through direct and substitute assets to get these programs back. I mean, we're already seeing that the latest published reports are that Social Security is going to be insolvent I think 2032 or 2035, Medicare Part A, not soon after. So these kind of roundups become, yeah, you know, these roundups become important because they help to potentially work to stave off what that insolvency is going to be. So it'll be interesting to see what comes about as a result of that. So good stuff, big cases, big dollar amounts. The fraud schemes, I don't think are all that novel. Again, it's recycling of a lot of these schemes. So we'll see what transpires in that. Wade, we miss you.
Who?
Maybe not. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So anyway, we've got lots of LinkedIn Lives scheduled. If you are keeping up with some of the other things, the LinkedIn Lives are being posted. We've got a whole bunch scheduled. Jean Marie's kind of side project that she's doing. The Long Island Library, two R's, Long Island Library, is fast and furious as well. If you're looking for a little fun stuff that she's doing, those are out every week as well in the newsletter. Catch that newsletter every week in your inbox. Check out our website and, of course, YouTube and Spotify for all of our produced material, such as our weekly OIG Roundtable. So thanks again, as always, and until next time, we'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable. Take care, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.